I know what we have to do.
It's in those eyes of yours.
You and I can finally be all right.
Well, not anymore.
I won't feel too inadequate or conservative anymore.
You wouldn't, only because there's consequences.
And when it's over, all that hostility and aggression will be gone.
By lying.
It'll be cathartic.
Is that supposed to be funny?
This will keep us together.
I won't deny my own personal desire.
What do you say?
It's trivial.
From Tuscaloosa, Alabama, this is Aspect Radio. I'm Corey Kraft.
And I am Ben Flanagan. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Aspect Radio. And Corey, I'm fresh off of seeing Woody Allen's Magic in the Moonlight for a second time at the Bama Art House here in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And I've got to admit, I was wrong. I was wrong about how much I liked it the first time. It's even better. And I would consider it top half, if not top tier, Woody Allen. So how do you like that?
I think this is an example of what you might call gotcha journalism.
Yeah.
You're putting me on the spot.
I feel
here.
Like Sean Hannity right now.
Cut his mic.
Told you.
He doesn't like Magic in the Moonlight. Cut it.
That's right.
Get him out of here.
I'll give you the last word. Cut. But we're not here to talk about Magic in the Moonlight. We've already done that, so go check that out. We're here to talk about two movies that we have not discussed at length on Aspect Radio yet, including Kevin Smith's new film, the horror film Tusk. But first off, Corey, David Fincher's new movie, Gone Girl, kicked off the fall season in a big way, number one at the box office, and arguably one of the most anticipated movies on our list in fall 2014.
Nick Dunn, you're probably the most hated man in America right now. Did you kill your wife, Nick?
Everyone told us and told us marriage is hard work. Not for me and Nick.
As you all know, my wife, Amy Elliott Dunn, disappeared 3 days ago. I had nothing to do with the disappearance of my wife. I have nothing to hide.
Has Amy got friends we can talk to?
No, not really.
You don't know if she has friends, you don't know what she does all day, and you don't know your wife's blood type.
Just being a good guy, so everybody can see him being a good guy.
Well, you really don't like him, do you?
All I'm trying to do is be nice to the people who are volunteering to help find Amy.
I will practice believing my husband loves me. But I could be wrong.
You ever seen that guy in the glasses before?
Amy is the kind of girl who attracts admirers.
Whoever took her is bound to bring her back.
I'm hoping you can tell me what this means.
You want to solve Amy's treasure hunt?
You seen this girl around here?
Yeah, I remember her.
I know you. I saw you at the volunteer center.
I wanted to help.
What'd she want?
She wanted a gun.
We are all scared, but we are all here now.
I feel like something to be jettisoned if necessary. I feel like I could disappear.
You read the book.
Yes.
I did not. You would have had a much clearer vision of what would transpire on screen before you actually saw it. I went in completely cold. I knew the very basic premise of this movie and nothing else before I sat down in a theater last Thursday night in Tuscaloosa and let it sort of wash over me. But more importantly, what got me in the theater, beyond the people in it, beyond the fact that it was an extremely popular book that sort of captivated a nation of readers, it's a new David Fincher movie. And that is an event unto itself, for us especially. The guy is on a hot streak, in my opinion, dating back to 2010, especially with Social Network, the Oscar-winning film written by Aaron Sorkin. He followed that up with a movie that I really liked, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is also based on an extremely popular piece of mainstream literature, a film that you didn't like as much. So maybe Gone Girl, you saw it as an opportunity for David Fincher to rebound as a filmmaker, although I don't think it would take much for him to rebound, considering how much you like his films. I want to be very careful about how much I talk about this movie. We have somebody in this room here that hasn't seen it, and I think it's extremely important for anybody who doesn't know anything about the details or specifics and the nature of how this story unfolds. I think it's important that you don't know that much going into it. So I'm going to be careful. You let loose if you want to. But my two questions are, has David Fincher rebounded from his previous effort, which you didn't like as much? And did this live up to your expectations as someone who read this book? And does that even matter?
Well, as someone who has read the book, I will say this. The movie is the book. It is extremely faithfully adapted down to tiny structure concerns. The first half of the movie is very, very similar in structure to the novel. And the first major twist in this movie, perhaps the most significant twist in this movie, which we should try to talk around, even though that's rather difficult, happens about halfway through the movie, just as it happens about halfway through the book. So, you know, if I benefited from anything having read the book going into the film, it's that I could keep up with the denseness of this plot, which comes at you so quickly through a social network-like barrage of information coming from the main and side characters in this movie. You know, I knew what to expect going in, so I was able to make a little bit of sense to it more quickly, I think. Not that this is a confusing movie, but, you know, there's a lot of moving pieces. There's a lot going on. As for whether it's a rebound, you know, yeah, you're right. I'm not a big fan of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo because I find that movie pretty oppressive, and I find it generally doesn't have a whole lot to say beyond its cursory concerns about violence against women. If you could make a criticism about Gone Girl, and I don't think I will, it's that Gone Girl has so much on its mind that the message can come off as a little all over the place. I mean, this is a film that I want to see for a second time just to parse through what I think Fincher's doing with the material, what he's saying about the various concerns that Gillian Flynn, through her adaptation of her novel, presents here about marriage, about the faces we put on, and perception in both our private lives and in the public arena through her criticism here and Fincher's criticism of the news media. There's a lot to unpack. But ultimately, Gone Girl is an extremely satisfying movie from David Fincher. I think it's outstanding. And if I'm comparing it to anything he's done previous to this, it's actually not one of the movies that he's done in the last few years, though I think it feels the most like that with Jeff Cronenworth as cinematographer and with Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross doing the score. But if I'm being honest, Gone Girl reminds me the most of Fincher's Fight Club from 1999, a sort of take-no-prisoner satire of masculinity. If Gone Girl's a satire of anything, you could say that it's a satire of that battle of the sexes and sort of its natural result in a culture that encourages idealization of one's romantic partner, if not outright competition. I think it's a great film.
I think it's really entertaining. I'm not sure I'm at great just yet, and I think that in a way, it's doing a disservice to this movie and movies like these to talk about it at length when you've only seen it one time.
Yeah.
And this one probably deserves, if not two viewings, then many more beyond that. And I look forward to going back and revisiting it because this movie clips along like any other David Fincher movie does, even at 2.5 hours in running time. When you say that this movie has a lot to say, and maybe perhaps too much in some cases, about halfway through the movie, when it pulls the rug out from under the audience in an effective way, I think it says as much as it's going to at that point and doesn't really have much to say after that. And I think it starts to go around in circles as the movie plays out. And as we see these arcs unfold and what is actually happening with these characters and what you see behind these faces that they present finally, that left me a little cold, and to feel a little cold at a David Fincher movie is not really saying much, but that's not to say that they're entirely removed experiences. This is incredibly involving and you pull for these characters and you're incredibly invested in this, maybe more so than most of his other movies. But what I'll say here, without giving too much away, is the marketing for this movie focuses heavily and very specifically on the first act of this movie.
That's accurate.
And the marketing does not give away anything beyond that, which is incredibly savvy of them. And I'm thankful that they did that, and I wish we would see that in marketing more often these days. And I think that that gives us a leg up going into it. And I'm proud of myself for avoiding spoilers as much as I did for this. Again, I didn't know anything going into it. And now I wonder if I did myself a disservice in a way, because you give yourself expectations for where the story could go, but that's the point of movies. You let it take you in as many different directions as you want it to, and this takes you in about 1,000. And I think for the most part, that's good. Again, it's incredibly involving and immersive. But with these kinds of movies, procedurals, mysteries, and then movies that sort of hint at the larger topics that you suggested before, I'm somebody who wants to see characters sort of get what they deserve. And that doesn't always happen in the movies.
No, it does not.
Or art in general. And that's okay. And that's something we as an audience with expectations have to accept. You have to just sort of absorb what the artists give you. I'm fine with that. But I'm just speaking as like almost a movie layman in a way, to where it's like, I'm that invested and I want bad things or good things to happen to these characters. And when they don't, you feel disappointed. But that also shows you the power of a film, the power of a story, when those things don't happen. I think back to something like No Country for Old Men,
right,
when I'm watching this movie and you think of the Javier Bardem character and what you may or may not want to happen to him, or what you may want to happen to the Josh Brolin or Kelly MacDonald characters, and things don't go the way you necessarily want them to. And I think that's kind of the case here watching this movie, but you have to understand what it is that David Fincher, and maybe more specifically Gillian Flynn, is doing here. And the reason that this movie might be incredibly loyal to that text is because Gillian Flynn adapted her own book into a screenplay, which we talked about on the last show and how rare that seems to be these days. But I think she does an incredibly good job. There's a lot of humor in
yes.
this movie, and it's written, again, at such a great pace. It's acted really well by Affleck, and the supporting cast is really terrific, and that includes Tyler Perry and Neil Patrick Harris, these people that you would least expect in a David Fincher movie. We know to trust David Fincher with cast, with crew, and obviously with story and things as dense as Gone Girl, but if I'm a little cold, it's only because I was walloped over the head with it the first time around, and I can't wait to go back and look at it again.
It's quite a wallop. And, you know, to speak again obliquely, there have been a number of similar criticisms about the ending of the novel. That's not an insignificant number of the novel's readers who come away feeling a little cold by the conclusion of the story here. For reasons we can't really get into, I think it's pretty perfect.
Yeah.
I think pretty much every character gets what they deserve to a certain degree.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, there's very... I don't know how to talk about this.
It's hard, I know.
Yeah, even to talk vaguely about it would be potentially giving too much away. In any case, I'm very satisfied with it, just on a dark comic scale.
Uh-huh.
And as a resolution of a mystery, I think it's tied up pretty firmly.
It's tied up, for sure, but I'm just telling you, I didn't necessarily... based on how I felt about the story right. and the characters, I wasn't necessarily satisfied with how it's tied up, but
yeah,
I think it has
yeah.
way more to do with how invested I was. And again, that's a strength of the movie and how it absorbs you. It's got nothing to do with what Gillian Flynn wrote and how the movie turned out. It's just, if you're invested in a soap opera
sure.
and one of your characters cheats on another or gets killed, you didn't want that to happen, but it happened, and you just got to move on with it.
Right.
But, you know, when this big twist happens midway through the movie, or after the first act is over, in a way it kind of loses me, and it becomes an entirely different movie than I was
expecting. It does
become
a different
yeah.
type of
movie.
A
total tonal and identity shift.
Yeah, yeah. I guess at that point you're either with it or you're not. But I think Fincher and Flynn are showcasing a very interesting sort of character and a very interesting sort of movie that sort of takes some ideas from popular culture, sort of takes some ideas from similar films, but adds a unique angle to it. A very type A, very confident sort of movie monster, a movie psychopath.
Yeah.
That ends up being extremely interesting to me in ways that I can't really think of too many, cinematic precedents for. And you're right. I mean, it doesn't hurt that this story is told with the utmost care and precision by David Fincher and by the cast of actors he's assembled to bring it to life. Because Ben Affleck, say what you will about him, of late, he's proven himself to be a valuable filmmaker, probably more so than he has ever been a valuable actor. And Rosamund Pike, though people like her as a screen presence, and she's showed up in smaller roles here and there in some really good films, and she's done really good work, an unproven leading lady. Well, you know, what better way to prove yourself than to be put through the trial by fire of a David Fincher film? And they both, I think, acquit themselves fantastically.
I think they do well enough. I do like Ben Affleck. I can't say that I'm as on board with Rosamund Pike.
Wow.
Because I think if you have a better actress, and this is, it's hard to say this without offense to Rosamund Pike. It's not that I haven't liked her in other movies like Pride and Prejudice and other The World's End and other movies that she's been in, but I think that there maybe could have been a better actress out there that he could cast in this role and realize it with the depth that it has, realize that on screen maybe more so than someone less as inexperienced as Rosamund Pike is. And she's good. She pulls it off. The movie happens and is mostly successful in my eyes, but I don't think that she necessarily brings it the strength that it probably deserves.
I think she's fantastic. I think she's the standout of the film. You know, she's almost like a Hitchcock blonde resurrected. I mean, I feel like Hitchcock would be pretty proud, pretty pleased with this film, all things considered. But I think she's terrific because it's a difficult role. It's a difficult role with many, many, many layers. And again, to get back to our thematic discussion, many sort of public and private faces to switch between. And I think she pulls it off tremendously. Affleck doesn't have as complicated of a role as the sort of beleaguered husband character who may or may not have killed his wife, but he sort of brings this innate untrustworthiness to this character, this sort of unconvincing shiftiness that I think really befits the character pretty perfectly. I mean, talk about putting an actor's natural talents to use. Anybody who's ever said that Affleck was an unconvincing actor before in roles that call upon him to be genuine, well, this is the perfect thing for him because I don't know that there's a genuine bone in this character's body.
I don't know, because without getting too in depth, you're talking about playing with the truth, unreliable narrators.
Yes.
Whose perspectives you can trust throughout this thing, and you quickly learn whom you can trust, again, about halfway through this movie, and who's been telling the truth, what kind of character those people have, and what levels of character that they have. Because you start to talk about who gets and what they deserve, and there are characters who go at far greater lengths than to do things to people that these people and these characters don't necessarily deserve.
Right.
And that is frustrating to me. And also, there are these characters who are very manipulative and calculating, and they've been that way the entire time, and they're that way all the way to the end of the film, and they get what they want, and they have for pretty much the entire movie, and it suggests the motives that they had and tells you way more about their past than you initially knew. And if they were going to be that way from beginning to end in retrospect, then I don't really understand why you tell the story in the first place, because not much changes about these characters, and especially this one character that I'm talking about. They don't really learn much. Their personality doesn't change. Their motives don't change. They get what they want, and it was going to be that way no matter what. And I'm just saying, if that's the case, then why go through it at all?
But the change is that character no longer has to pretend. Character was always that way, yes, but it's sort of about relaxing that public facade to a degree. And by the film's end, that character has sort of raised a new public facade, but one that is to this character's utmost design. You know, this is what the culture at large has wrought, trying to fit people into boxes, I think is what Fincher's trying to say. Eventually, you're going to have someone like this character who rejects that notion to a violent, incredibly sociopathic degree. And yes, it's over the top. It's inherently ridiculous. But I think that by making it so exaggerated, as the last part of this film goes into some incredibly dark, over-the-top areas, by making it this exaggerated, I think it brings home the point in a way that something like Fight Club does. That's why I think that's its closest sort of cinematic equivalent.
There's a lot of humor in this movie, and there has been so in Fincher's past movies for sure, but there is also very much a level of seriousness to his work. And you start to wonder as you're watching this movie, is satirizing Nancy Grace beneath David Fincher?
It's low-hanging fruit.
It certainly is, and that doesn't seem to work, I guess, in his universe, and that kind of felt phony to me, and it's not something that we've necessarily seen in his past work to date, but there are certain things like that that feel a little flimsier than the work that we've seen from him in the past. And I mentioned soap opera before for a very specific reason, because, you know, I've heard people say that this movie acts as the best Dateline or 2020 episode they've ever seen, and there are instances and themes and sequences in here that border, I'll just say border, on something you might see on Lifetime. And it certainly has a lot more depth than that, but barely.
Yeah, I don't agree.
I think a lot of people associate Lifetime and reality television and these other things. They sort of put them all in the same ballpark. And I think that there are elements of this movie that, while it might try to satirize those things and might try to use elements of that to tell a more focused and substantial story, it sort of gets away from that substance at times and sort of just turns into one of those movies instead.
I will say this, that there are elements of the first half of the movie that are perhaps exaggerated to a degree, made extra Lifetime-y to a degree on purpose.
Sure.
By design.
Sure.
Because as we learn, there are elements that we cannot exactly trust that may actually have been based on, to a certain degree, popular culture. The Lifetime movie, the Crime 2020 episode, things like that. So, you know, I guess that would be my rebuttal. It doesn't have to work for everybody, but those parts of the book are like that too. They're written in a very specific way that is, quite frankly, a little irritating. And then you get to a point in the movie where the rug gets pulled out from under you.
Yeah.
And, you know, you hear the true voice of that character.
Yeah, and you just start to wonder, though, if you're doing all of these things on purpose and you do it a lot throughout telling this story, at what point do you just become that, what you're trying to do on purpose, what you're trying to satirize or parody? At what point do you stop blurring the line and just make this very complete transition into being that thing instead of pretending to be that thing to make a joke?
Well, I mean, you know, the same criticisms have been levied against Fight Club.
Uh-huh.
At what point are you not making fun of sort of bridled, destructive masculinity and its natural outcome? And at what point are you glorifying it or wallowing in it? I mean, these are the criticisms that have been levied against Fincher before. I think, well, first of all, you need to see Gone Girl again. And I think that the years will be kind to it, just as the years have been kind to Fight Club, because it's the sort of movie that you have to sit on. You have to let it percolate.
Yeah. I don't know that the years have been that kind of Fight Club.
I think Fight Club's still pretty good.
It's pretty good, but it's pretty overzealous, too, in the message it's trying to send out there.
It's very 90s.
Well, it's 90s, but it's
very
also
pre-recession.
It's just very loud. It's very much an attention horror in a way, I think, in the manner in which people speak and how they transmit this message that they're trying to send out there. And you know very much that this is a movie about masculinity,
right,
and this is a satire because it calls so much attention to itself.
I think Gone Girl does the same thing. So if you're a little cool on Fight Club, maybe that's why you're a little cool on Gone Girl.
Maybe, but I think the strength of this movie and the story is in the mystery that it presents in the first act. And if it had something else to say, then that's fine. And I think it does it well enough for the most part, but I think it strays a bit from what gave it its strength and what grabs you in the first act of this thing with the characters that it has. Rest of the movie.
The mystery ends up just being what propels you to what it's really about.
Right.
Ultimately.
Yeah, that's true. And fine, you know, and if you want to make a movie about marriage and sort of the pitfalls of it and do it in the way that it does, using very extreme circumstances and things that happen in this movie, then yes, it is pretty funny. And there are great exchanges between Affleck and Rosamund Pike, which are incredibly dark and darkly funny, too. But it all seemed a bit easy at times. I want to point out there are a couple of supporting actors that are really good. We already mentioned Harrison Perry, but I think Carrie Coon, who plays Ben Affleck's sister, is excellent. Kim Dickens as Detective Rhonda Boney, I think, is fantastic.
My second favorite performance of the movie, actually. She's really wonderful.
Yeah, she's really good. And there are times when you're rooting for that character, too. And you don't always get what you want, and neither do the characters. And if you get too invested in those and in their motives and their desires, so to speak, and in how things are going to turn out to them, then you're setting yourself up for disappointment, not in terms of how you view the movie or story critically, but because you're so enveloped by what's going on. And again, that's the strength of that story. So I don't want to act like the story fails, because I think it does what it wants and it does so successfully. It's just a matter of whether or not you find yourself disappointed with it if you're invested in it.
Well, give it a little time, you know, catch it again, maybe on Blu-ray or something after. Well, I mean,
it's like on the next episode of Gone Girl, you know, that's kind of what I'm waiting for.
I mean, the thing is, like,
and I'm not going to get it.
I don't know if you experience this, but you know, you build something up because you're hyped up for it so much.
Yeah.
And that initial hype, that burst, you run out opening weekend, you see it. And sometimes you find yourself a little let down. But I mean, this, I kind of feel like this is what happened with me and The Master.
Yeah.
It took me until that second viewing months later to really like wrap my head around what it was really trying to do.
Right.
And once I got there, I got there. Now, I'm not saying this will ever happen with you and right. Gone Girl, but, you know, put a little distance between yourself, maybe the initial hype
sure.
and
just,
the film.
I don't think that there is nearly as much depth and substance to this movie as there is to something like The Master.
Well, I don't,
and I know
I
that you're
either.
Using that as a, yeah. you know, as an example, but what you see in a way is what you get with this movie, but because it's David Fincher, that alone makes it worth revisiting. So I'm going to do it, but I just fear that I know what I'm going to know. So we'll see.
Well, it sounds like your first big fall movie was a little disappointing.
It's hard to say because it's so, you're glued to it.
Yeah.
From beginning to end. And if a movie can entertain you for 2.5 hours that way, and you can sort of bask in the technical glory of right. it, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross's score, which is fantastic.
It is fantastic.
And there are a couple of tracks in there that remind me of Angela Badalamenti at
absolutely.
Times. Yeah, especially during flashback sequences.
And I'm not just saying that because I've got Twin Peaks on the brain for obvious reasons. But
no, I thought about it when I was watching the movie, and that news hadn't broken at that point. And yeah, they are 3 for 3 collaborating with him, and the cinematography and the editing is all fantastic. These are things that you know to expect with David Fincher. So I can say that I highly recommend seeing this movie. That's not a disappointment. So the movie's still in theaters. It will be for a while, so check it out. Check your local listings.
I don't want you to go to Canada tomorrow.
It's for the podcast. It's what I do.
I travel around and I interview weird or interesting people.
So look out, you crazy Canucks!
Wandering Wallace takes a raunchy road trip up to the Great White North.
Hello, I'm an old man who has enjoyed a long and storied life at sea. And after eons of oceanic adventure, I know I do not wish to spend my remaining years alone when I have such stories to share.
How far is Bifrost from here?
It's about 2 hours from here.
It's about 2 hours away.
I hate American guys.
Good evening.
It's nice to meet you.
Could I interest you in some tea?
So what happened after the boat sank?
I was alone, and then something very swift and frightening moved by me.
A walrus saved your life?
The walrus is far more evolved than any man I've ever known, present company included.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Would you?
There. It'll be all right, Mr. Tusk.
Kevin Smith has a new movie out. It's called Tusk. It's another horror movie.
I don't know if it's out anymore.
Well,
it may have come and gone.
Sure. Well, it was out briefly. It was here for less than a week in Tuscaloosa, and I'm glad that I saw it because I'm a guy, unlike you, who is mostly a fan of Kevin Smith and have been since his first film, Clerks, from all the way back in 1994. I've tended to follow him ever since then, even though I've been pretty disappointed with a lot of his directorial efforts. But I've always thought that, well, I think it's clear that he made a masterpiece in Clerks for many different reasons, because not only is it a really funny movie shot on this shoestring budget, it obviously has this production story and distribution story that has now become that of legend in the independent film circles in history. Yeah. But it paved the way for a lot of filmmakers to do something similar, and there are filmmakers out there who might not exist if it weren't for Kevin Smith and what he did with Clerks. And I am personally a monstrous fan of his third movie, Chasing Amy, a film that I know that you're not as big a fan of. Yeah. I think it's his best film, and I think it's great, and it holds up every time I watch it. So with those two movies alone, Kevin Smith kind of gets a pass from me, because I'm just a big enough fan of those, so I hold him in high enough or just generally positive regard, so that if he's making something or if he's saying something, then I'll poke my head in the door and see what it is, at least, if I'm not going to catch it in the theater or if I'm not going to just totally invest my time in it. So he made a horror movie a couple of years ago called Red State, starring Michael Parks and a handful of others, that sort of went in one ear and out the other for most horror fans and a lot of Kevin Smith fans. It does have its fan base, I guess, because he has his fan base, and people are going to lap up a lot of pretty much whatever he does. I was pretty lukewarm on it. I think it had a lot of potential, and it had a great lead performance from a guy like Michael Parks, who is just drastically, obviously, underutilized. And after seeing stuff like From Dusk Till Dawn and the Grindhouse work that he did,
and the aforementioned Twin Peaks.
So we know that this guy's really talented, and it's good to see guys like Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez and Kevin Smith taking advantage of his obvious talent. He's back with Kevin Smith in this movie, Tusk, which has an interesting story unto itself in that the genesis, the germ of an idea that percolated from Kevin Smith and his podcasting buddy Scott Mosier a year or two ago, I don't know when exactly they did this, they came up with an idea for this film and basically talked it through from beginning to end and thought, wouldn't it just be funny if we made that movie? And here they are, they've made the movie that they talked about in their stone stupor or whatever it was. And the result is something that came from a stone stupor. In my opinion, you've got this story about a podcaster who goes on the road into the Canadian wilderness to interview someone interesting who happens to be this paraplegic old man with many stories to tell, played by Michael Parks. He's like this sort of creepy millionaire type who is extremely mysterious, which is why this podcaster played by Justin Long goes to visit him so he can get these stories. Well, it turns out he has ulterior motives, and I don't want to get into spoiler territory here, Corey, but this is just what it's about. Okay, so he basically kidnaps Justin Long and has the intention of turning him into a walrus. And that's basically the plot of this thing. And after that, Justin Long's podcasting partner and girlfriend try to find out where he is after he's gone missing. So anyway, it's a pretty ridiculous idea for a movie here, Corey, but I will say that as somebody who has followed Kevin Smith's career and, you know, somebody who's a fan of what he's done over the years, I admit that he is not the most technically gifted filmmaker or even the most gifted storyteller. And he'd probably be the first person to admit that.
So but what's left?
I think the first act of this movie, again, kind of like how I felt with Gone Girl, is actually really well done, well written, well acted, and well shot. Perhaps for the first time in Kevin Smith's career. And it was building on something highly original and unusual. And then it takes this turn that we knew it was going to take. And I've got to think, if I'm trying to get in the mind of the person who put up whatever money was required to make this movie, I slap myself on the forehead and say, you know what? I should have known this is what I was going to get if I gave these stoned idiots my money.
Well, look, I'll see your first act, but I'll only actually say there may be about 10 minutes of the first act that I would concede are compelling. And that's that first conversation between Justin Long and Michael Parks.
Which is really good.
I wouldn't say that it's really good.
Michael Parks is really good.
Michael Parks is really good. Michael Parks, bless his heart, is committed to this absolutely bug nuts.
He'll
role.
Do anything.
Evidently.
It's obvious that he will do anything his director, if he believes in that director,
right,
asks him to.
Why he chose this particular director to trust so deeply, I don't know. But I'll begrudgingly say he was pretty good in Red State, a movie I really don't like. He's better in this because it's stranger and he's yet more committed to it. That's about all I'll give Tusk, because I suppose by Kevin Smith standards it's nice looking, but I don't think I'd say that really otherwise.
I think it earns a really sort of unusual and original creepiness during that first meeting between these characters.
But where does that go?
Well, it doesn't really go anywhere, but it exists in that moment.
In the moment, maybe.
And that's
there's a tension there.
Well, yeah, and I think that it captures something that a lot of horror movies, for that matter, don't really get these days.
But that's like the basic thing a horror movie has to get.
Well, we're not really seeing that.
It's
anymore,
a little
though.
Bit of tension. All right.
There's so, more than just a little bit of tension.
Well, okay,
though.
So there's one scene that has tension.
Right.
Good job in your horror movie, Kevin Smith. You achieved the bare minimum.
Right. Again, this movie goes off the rails.
I don't know that it was ever
that.
On the rails.
Well, it was, I think.
I don't think
it was a strange idea, but I think it was on the rails for a little bit. And we all know, if we knew just sort of the basic premise of this or any details beyond it, that it was going to get weird. And it does get weird, as promised on that podcast and in production. It gets really strange and awfully stupid. You know, as you're watching this, it's hard to sit back and say, okay, I get the joke. I knew that it was going to get weird. Let me bask in it a little bit. Let me laugh with the joke. But at a certain point, it's hard to even do that. And it's hard not to just sit there and say, you know what? This is just dumb.
It moves from horror into something trying to be horror comedy.
Yeah.
And there's no comedy. There's a scene, all right, about, I guess, two-thirds of the way through the movie. The co-podcaster and the girlfriend, played by Haley Joel Osment, Academy Award nominee Haley Joel Osment.
And I'll say, look, I'll admit this, as somebody who was never a big fan of his, it's good to see Haley Joel Osment again.
I'm pleased to see him. And Genesis Rodriguez, they go to Canada. They meet up with an inspector, a retired detective, played by...
Nah, hold on.
I'm not going to say.
Okay.
An unbilled actor of some renown, who, by the way, is probably better off unbilled. Because I don't understand why anyone would want to put their name on this performance.
Yeah.
In any case... There is a flashback scene with this actor and Michael Parks on the porch of a cabin, and it is the single most embarrassing thing that an established adult filmmaker has broadcast onto theater screens just about ever. I was cringing the entire time.
I don't know that I would go that far, but this actor that you mentioned, along with Michael Parks, whom you'll recognize immediately.
Sure, it's not a convincing disguise.
Right. When you see him at first, you think, oh, well, this is interesting. It's and then not. When his scenes play out and he...
When he opens his mouth.
Yeah, when he opens his mouth and God. Uses this weird accent and goes with this weird look and really just generally this character. If you want to talk about going off the rails with the horror comedy element and just general concept that Kevin Smith has, that's one thing. But unfortunately, just in terms of the story and the quality of the movie, that character single-handedly derails this movie.
It's not single-handed. He has some help.
I think he does, though. It's really Kevin Smith's fault more than anything, especially giving this actor the freedom that he obviously has when they made this movie, just to let him improv away and pretty much do whatever he wants with this very strange and kind of lazily constructed character that he's given us here. And yes, you mentioned the scene with Michael Parks. There's also a scene in a fast food restaurant. There are a couple more. Every scene that he's in feels like it's 2 hours long.
Yeah.
And that's not good.
No.
Especially when you're looking for momentum at this point. Once he enters the story, instead, you just stand still in quicksand for just chunks at a time, and it just kind of ruins it. Not to say that the whole transformation, so to speak, didn't already do that in a way, but it sort of throws you even further down into a rabbit hole you never wanted to enter in the first place.
The full glimpse of the finished product.
Right.
Of,
that's when it gets pretty dumb.
I mean, I was just aghast.
Yeah, not because of how gross it is,
no.
Or, you know, because there are elements of body horror in this that
certainly
he employs.
Not. It's not a Videodrome situation,
right,
where you can't believe what you're seeing.
Right.
I can't believe what I'm seeing in a different sort of way. Like, somebody actually released this.
You know, at the end of this movie, which overall is not very satisfying, I guess, but it's hard for me not to say you shouldn't go see this, because I think either fans of Kevin Smith or even fans of horror, because I think that this movie is going to have legs just for the sake of it.
Because it's so weird.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that that's probably the intention. I'd recommend seeing it just to say you saw it and just so you can sort of point and laugh with everybody else. But
nah.
During the closing credits of this movie, I was in the Cobb Hollywood 16, and there was this group of young guys who were obviously big Kevin Smith fans. And as people were leaving the theater, surprisingly, nobody left midway through this movie. But as they were leaving, these guys would ask people what they thought of it, because they're in on the joke. They get it, and they want to laugh at the people who didn't get the joke, I guess. They're like, what'd you think of the movie? They asked me when it was over. They said, sir, what'd you think? And I said, it's pretty wacky, huh? And this one guy goes, you know it's all a big fucking joke, right? Like that. And I was like, I'm sure Kevin Smith really appreciate you explaining the joke to everybody as they're leaving the theater, but I just don't think that that's necessary, and it's a shame that anybody has to. And Kevin Smith, as somebody, I've listened to his Smodcast, which this originated from, since then, since the movie's come out, since the critics have either hammered it or fans have embraced it, and he seems right with the world. He seems satisfied with what movie he made. He set out to do something, and he obviously did it, so it seems like whatever criticism people are going to level at this film and at him for making it, it's going to bounce right off of his back, and good for him. Because again, it's hard to begrudge a guy for making the movie he wanted to make, but as somebody who was a fan, of his potential in some of the films that he made. And this is a guy who said multiple times that he was done with filmmaking, he was going to retire. So as a fan of his, when you see him get back into the game and say, you know what, I'm going to stick around, I'm going to keep making movies, and this is what he does, it's hard not to be a little disappointed.
Yeah, a little. If this is a joke, who is the joke on? Is the joke on the audience for paying Kevin Smith to see this stoned fever dream that he translated to the screen? Is the joke on Kevin Smith's financiers and his continued ability
I
to get money?
Probably on them, yes.
What,
yeah.
What is the joke? I know the joke. It's a stupid-ass idea for a movie.
Right.
Apart from that, what is the joke? Oh, look, this is so ridiculous. And yes, it's dumb and bad, but it's dumb and bad on purpose, but it's not, but kinda.
Right.
But we're, you know, even though it's kind of dumb and bad, we're winking and nudging you in the ribs. Great, Kevin Smith. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you for not trying again.
But see, it's hard for me to just say he didn't try at all, because there are things in this movie that show a more mature filmmaker than who existed before.
See,
things.
I think that Red State was a more honest attempt at that.
I think this is honestly a better movie than Red State.
I don't know. I think they're both pretty terrible, but I got the sense in Red State that that was, you know, just something he... I mean, he had talked it up forever.
Right. He got it out of his system.
And he was passionate about it.
Right.
And he wanted to make this transition, and he wanted to try something new. I don't like that movie at all, but I can kind of get behind that. Like, well, you tried, but you messed up.
Right.
Better luck next time. Next time is Tusk, which is, I had this stupid idea, and I just, you know, I thought, well, why not? Well, the why not is because not everybody is as stoned as you are, Kevin Smith. That's
yeah.
Why not.
Well, yeah, and yeah, this is the result of a conversation between a couple of stoners. It's amazing that you would put up more than a few bucks to make it,
yeah.
But somebody did, and that's on them. That's on their conscience.
I genuinely just felt embarrassed. I really did. Like, the whole time I was just like, you know, somebody sold me a ticket to this. I just felt embarrassed to be there.
Forget them. Somebody selling you a ticket. They sold you the ticket. You're the one who bought it.
No, I know.
You knew
what it was going to be.
And
I just had this vision of the ticket guy being like, we got another asshole going to see Tusk. Poor bastard. What a joke. I wonder
if he likes
this stuff.
Right.
What an idiot.
Whoa.
And I just had this, like, I know that's not true. And then I just picture Kevin Smith, like, taking my $10 bill and using it to light his bowl. Just, like,
yeah.
Setting that $10 bill aflame and, like, holding it up to his bowl full of marijuana and being like, man, you get so much more high when you light it with money.
To his credit, he was never dishonest about what he was selling you.
No, that's true. I deserve it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. I deserve it.
You walked into it.
I had a morbid curiosity.
You handed him your money to light up the...
That morbid curiosity was fulfilled, and I got what I deserved.
Well, at your own risk, see Tusk. Corey's telling you, we're both telling you that it's really going to be a huge waste of your time.
Yeah, it is.
But, you know, the conversation that they had that made this movie was a huge waste of time, and I'm sure that they would probably admit that too. But
I just, you know, it's like, you know, we get upset sometimes when auteur directors, like, they go into the big studio game, right? You know, oh man, this director I really like is directing a remake of whatever. You know, oh, that's just going to be ruined by the studio. They're wasting a couple years putting something like that together. With Kevin Smith, I guess you could at least say that he's stuck to his guns. But yeah, to what end? You know, at what point are you just like, no, really, man, you kind of need some studio notes here. But I'm not sure.
I'd love to see studio notes.
Yeah, that's
on
cop
this
out,
movie.
Man. And cop out is worse than
no,
this
I mean,
movie.
Yeah, on this movie.
On
I'd
this
love,
movie.
I'd love to see Harvey Weinstein or even like an even bigger wig like Joel Silver or Scott Rudin send Tusk notes.
I guess
see
the
when
is,
the walrus
like,
suit yeah goes on, then you might want to consider maybe doing this or that.
It's difficult enough when a talented filmmaker wastes their time doing something.
Oh, you're saying he's not a talented filmmaker.
I don't think he is a talented filmmaker. I'll tell you that. Like, I like Clerks.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really like Chasing Amy.
Mm-hmm.
I like Mallrats. And I even kind of like Clerks 2 in its own low-budget, Shaggy Dog sort of way. It is what it is. But you're revisiting something he was comfortable with, and it's fine. This guy has not grown. This guy has not progressed as a filmmaker. He stuck to his guns, but his guns suck. I mean, if you can trace your career from, what, 1994 to 2014, and the best you can say is, well, he did a movie with Bruce Willis that didn't work out, and yeah, there was that one with the walrus, but it's basically the same. I mean, what the
hell? It's not the same as Cop Out. That's not fair, and I don't think it's fair to say that he hasn't gotten better or hasn't matured as a filmmaker.
I don't think he has at all.
I just don't think that he has built his maturation and his evolution as a storyteller. I don't think he's built that into one cohesive product yet. I think he's still got it in him somewhere, but I think he's a little too satisfied in doing what he's doing right now, so I doubt we'll ever get that, unfortunately.
Well, no loss, because I don't believe it's coming. Frankly, I feel like his threats to retire that he went back on, that's just all the worse for us. But I guess I don't have to pay to see his movies,
yeah,
so
well,
I don't know what my problem is either.
Well,
we're both stuck in this destructive relationship.
You'll pay to see anything.
Yeah, me and Kevin
whatever.
Smith in Gone Girl 2.
You'll pay to see the movies that are seriously trying to do what he's joking about doing
yeah.
with this movie.
No, you're right.
So that's your own sad life
yeah,
that you've got to live.
Get horror movies on video on demand like every weekend.
Right.
So.
I'm sure you'll probably go home and watch Human Centipede 4 or whatever.
Oh, man, those movies are terrible. Don't
right, but you've seen them, haven't you?
Yeah, I've
yeah,
seen
okay.
them.
The end. So Tusk is no longer out in theaters, at least not here, but it'll be available somewhere sometime soon. So that
it's
about
better than the Human Centipede movies. Put that
okay,
on the
well, yeah,
put that on the
go.
Blu-ray case.
That's
better than Human Centipede. Corey Kraft,
that's
Aspect
really,
Radio.
Yeah, that's really big of you, Corey. I'm proud of you. So that's it. That does it. Check us out at aspectradioshow.com. Find us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at Aspect Radio. Find us on Facebook. Read Corey's stuff at tusk205.com. Read my stuff at al.com. Check out filmnerds.com. So again, thank you for listening. We'll try and talk soon. Hopefully we can do something for the Halloween season, maybe something on some horror movies that we actually like.
I just watched Exorcist 2, The Heretic.
Oh, boy. I think
that's not a horror movie that I really like.
I'm going to DVR Poltergeist 3, and then maybe we can do a few hours on those. That's the one with Tom Skerritt, I think.
Yeah.
In the skyscraper.
What is the... I don't know how familiar you are with the Amityville horror movies. There's one Amityville horror sequel with a spooky lamp. I think it's Amityville Horror 4.
Uh-huh.
That's what we should talk about. Amityville Horror 4, : The Spooky Lamp.
Jeez, what are we getting ourselves into?
This is October for me. This isn't unusual. This
sure.
is October.
Okay, well, thanks everybody for listening. Until next time, I'm Ben Flanagan.
And I'm Corey Kraft. This is Aspect Radio. Bye-bye.